This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Iowa speaks, Clinton and Sanders throw down, Zika fears, Syria, and the president visits a mosque. Ted Cruz came out on top in the GOP in Iowa, savored the win the next morning, already in New Hampshire.
So what a victory last night.
Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders battling hard last night in debate over who's the progressive, over money and influence.
I think it's time to end the very artful smear that you and your campaign have been carrying out in recent weeks. And let's talk about the issues.
And Zika fear spreads, an emergency declared in five counties in Florida to stay ahead of it. Here's Florida Governor Rick Scott.
We have to ensure that Florida is safe. Second hurricane. What we always say to ourselves is we're going to prepare for the worst, hope for the best, and we're going to do everything we can to stay ahead of the Zika virus.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News, John McCormick of the Weekly Standard, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on who's a progressive, who's right for the GOP, and are you ready to see your daughters registered for the draft? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Manchester, New Hampshire, is Kelly O'Donnell, Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC News, out on the trail. Kelly, thank you very much for being with us.
Love being with you.
And from Manchester, New Hampshire, John McCormick joins us, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. John McCormick, welcome back to On Point.
Tom, thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, boy, do we have New Hampshire covered. Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kelly, and John.
Okay, we're going to dive into both camps. Let's go first with the Democrats. They were on TV last night. There was a kind of ramp to that appearance. Here was Hillary Clinton with that razor-thin victory celebrating earlier in the week.
I am so thrilled that I'm coming to New Hampshire after winning Iowa. I can tell you, I've won and I've lost there. It's a lot better to win.
Was it a win? Bernie Sanders says, well, it's basically a tie.
Tonight, while the results are still not known, it looks like we are in a virtual tie.
And then this question in Keene, New Hampshire on Tuesday.
You think Hillary Clinton is a progressive?
Some days, yes. Except when she announces that she is a proud moderate. And then I guess she is not a progressive.
And pretty soon we're talking, Hillary Clinton's talking about an artful smear. Last night things got really tense in the MSNBC debate in New Hampshire. Clinton.
I think it's time to end the very artful smear that you and your campaign have been carrying out in recent weeks. And let's talk about the issues.
Let's talk about issues.
With campaign finance reform.
Let's talk about issues.
I worked hard for McCain-Feingold. I want to reverse Citizens United.
Whoa, Kelly O'Donnell, last night things were really roaring there on who's the progressive, who might feel the influence of money. What did you make of that standoff?
That particular exchange, I think, will last long after this campaign season, in part because I think it was at the core of what has and her supporters in the rise of Bernie Sanders. And it was very telling. I think one of the most subtle and yet impactful moments was if you listen carefully and you can hear that deep voice of Bernie Sanders reacting with the,
yes.
And that says so much. He believes that the claims he has made, the charges he has made have been inbounds, fair, tough, but appropriate. And she was suggesting that he has gone too far. That is really the weapon that the Clinton campaign is using now to try to cast Bernie Sanders as being out of bounds. And his supporters, who are among the most passionate I have seen on the campaign trail this year, I have been out with both the Clinton and Bernie Sanders campaigns. And the passion factor is very high for Sanders. He has some real deep roots on these issues. And for Hillary Clinton, who was masterful in many ways during the debate, that was a sharp, sharp exchange. And I really believe that we will look back on that in cycles to come as one of the classic moments of the democratic process of how we fight for nominations in this country. It was very powerful.
Artful smear, she said Sanders was laying on her, and she'd had enough of it, suggesting he was accusing her of corruption.
There is this attack that he is putting forth, which really comes down to, you know, anybody who ever took donations or speaking fees from any interest group has to be bought. And I just absolutely reject that, Senator. And I really don't think these kinds of attacks by insinuation are worthy of you. And enough is enough. If you've got something to say, say it directly.
Enough is enough. But Sanders didn't exactly back down. Once again, he made the point he thinks the system is corrupt.
There is a reason why these people are putting huge amounts of money into our political system. And in my view, it is undermining American democracy, and it is allowing Congress to represent wealthy campaign contributors and not the working families of this country.
Well, you know, Senator,
John McCormick, I'll come to you on this, but Jack Beatty, what do you see in this exchange?
Well, you know, Bernie, I think, lost his fastball at a crucial moment there. And experts quoted by Politico today say, oh, he couldn't point to any quid pro quo. He can. There is one. It's the Elizabeth Warren story. Anyone can look it up on YouTube, her interview with Bill Moyers from 2004. Basically, it's this. As a Harvard professor, she wrote a piece saying that a bankruptcy bill that was on Bill Clinton's desk in the last year of the Clinton administration would harm families, and especially women in divorce who are being abandoned by their husbands and having to file for bankruptcy. She wrote this piece. Hillary Clinton called to see her. They had a session. Hillary went to the White House. There was hell to pay because the president was ready to sign the bill. And Hillary said, you can't do this. This is going to hurt women. He vetoed the bill. It was the last action as president. Then 4 years, 3.5 years later, Hillary is the senator from New York, elected with money from the same firms that she was decrying in 2000. And she turns around on the same bill and votes for the bankruptcy bill. That's the quid. There's a quid pro quo. And why Bernie didn't cite it, I don't know.
John McCormick, was Hillary Clinton successful in, you know, blocking this line of attack, saying, yes, I took money? I mean, we heard that all week long. They offered it to me, she said, of the nearly $700,000 from Goldman Sachs. So, but I'm not influenced by it. Or was Bernie Sanders more effective? He may not have had a fastball on the detail there, but he's saying, look, you have all this money in there. It can't help but have an influence. Donald Trump has said the same thing. What's message is winning in the Democrats' camp, John?
Oh, I think Bernie's message on this wins hands down. You know, in an age of economic stagnation and political gridlock, you see voters in both parties simply rejecting the system outright, rejecting the establishment, politics as usual. And, you know, I mean, to people left and right, Republican and Democrat, independent, the idea that someone is going to get paid $675,000 for a few speeches. Well, what are you getting paid for? Bernie Sanders has raised the question. And this is, again, things that former Republican presidents do, former Democratic presidents do, Democratic secretaries of state, Republican secretaries of state. And I think that the American people do see something just obscene about that amount of money in politics. And what exactly are they trying to gain here? What kind of influence are they trying to buy? Those are the questions that are on the top of people's minds and wondering why things can't get done. I think there are better explanations for why things can't get done. It's simply that we are ideologically divided and Congress is Republican and the presidency is Democratic. But when people see the system isn't working, things aren't getting done, they're starting to reject the system outright.
Let's get the American people right in here right now. Pam in Monticello, Kentucky. Pam, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to say that when I hear the words practical and pragmatic and compromise, I feel these are code words that protect, that are meant to protect the uber rich. And when Hillary said there will never be a single payer healthcare system, that came straight out of the mouths of the insurance company lobbyists. And also, today it's being touted that, oh, there's a 2.5% raise in wages. And what is 2.5% for somebody who's making $10? It's 25 cents an hour.
Pam, I take your big point, but let me ask you a question. What if Hillary's right? What if you can't get single payer through? And she's just saying, I've seen the politics, you can't get it through. Is that supporting the insurance companies, or is that a different kind of practical?
It's supporting the insurance companies, because of course there can be a single payer system. Medicare proves that. I'd like to raise one other point. The U.S. this week announced that they're going to be producing nuclear-armed cruise missiles. This is definitely something that Bernie Sanders would not stand for, I think.
Pam, we've got it. Let me take it to Kelly first. Kelly, you hear that? I mean, that's bad news for Hillary Clinton right there. Pam says, look, I hear practical and I hear pragmatic, and it sounds like code words for protecting the super rich. Surely that's not what she's trying to communicate anyway.
No, what she's trying to say is that she has existed in a world as a senator, and certainly from her time in the White House as First Lady with a keen observation on the political landscape, and certainly during this campaign in a world where the practical realities, to use a word that might be a dog whistle in some parts of the political spectrum, to say it is not something that can be achievable. And a big part of the Hillary Clinton campaign message is the results piece that she thinks she can promise. And when you're working in divided government, when there are certainly a large number of Republicans who will likely retain the House, even if they lose control of the Senate and Democrats are back in charge, there are even a few moderate Democrats from redder states that do not want to see a universal single-payer system across the spectrum. The difference for many is that when you're talking about Social Security, you're talking about a class of Americans who have already worked, paid into that system, and although we have a much growing elderly population and a senior population, that it is a different sort of economics when you're talking about the young and able, the middle-aged, and so forth. So in terms of politics and political reality, getting something like that done would need overwhelming Democratic control, something that I think Clinton says she doesn't see in the next few years.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Iowa speaks, Cruz, Clinton, Sanders, Trump, Rubio, everything in play. Zika fears out there. Syria in the spotlight this week. The president visits a mosque. Kelly O'Donnell, NBC News correspondent, is with us from Manchester, New Hampshire. John McCormick, senior writer at the Weekly Standard, is with us from Manchester as well. Jack Beatty's with us from New Hampshire. And you can join us. Democrats, were you watching last night all week? What do you want? Political revolution? Practical progress? What's the right move here? And Republicans, what do you want? Do you want ideological purity, anti-establishment fervor, or a winner, Donald Trump might say? Of course, Ted Cruz coming out with a clear victory, at least before the fraud charges, but still look pretty clear. In Iowa, Trump on Monday night, gracious in his way in defeat. He said everyone told him not to go to Iowa because he wouldn't even finish in the top 10.
We finished second, and I want to tell you something. I'm just honored. I'm really honored. And I want to congratulate Ted, and I want to congratulate all of the incredible candidates, including Mike Huckabee, who's become a really good friend of mine. So congratulations to everybody.
Okay, there was the gracious part. Then Trump back on Boston Herald Radio on Wednesday, accusing Ted Cruz of committing voter fraud of a kind to win Iowa. Said Cruz spread a CNN report suggesting Ben Carson was getting out of the race, accused Cruz of sending out mailers to Iowa voters, accusing them of a voting violation to scare them away from the polls.
It's a total voter fraud when you think of it. And he picked up a lot of those votes, and that's why the polls were so wrong, because of that.
So do you plan on...
I couldn't understand why the polls were wrong.
And here's Cruz punching back, saying, oh, watch out for Trump. He would nuke Denmark.
We need someone with judgment and the temperament to keep this country safe. I don't know anyone who would be comfortable with someone who behaves this way having his finger on the button. I mean, we're liable to wake up one morning and Donald, if he were president, would have nuked Denmark.
Okay. John McCormick, can we just first of all deal with the fraud assertion here? Is there anything to that? Does it matter? Could it have changed the way things work? Is Cruz still taking heat for it?
It definitely couldn't have changed the outcome. I mean, Ben Carson overperformed his polls. I don't think there's much evidence that exaggerating the stories that were out there in the press really did things. It's really not anything that you would call fraud in any technical sense of the term. Maybe it's tough stuff, rough and tumble politics, but certainly not as bad as Donald Trump saying that Cruz is ineligible to be president because he was born in Canada to an American parent. So I don't think there's much to that.
But here we are now, and how do you interpret the Cruz outcome in Iowa? And does it mean something for New Hampshire, or are they just different beasts, John?
They are different beasts. I mean, if you want to know why Cruz outperformed the polls, it's that the polls were projecting an electorate that was 47% evangelical Christian. Well, the voters who showed up on Election Day, they were the electorate was 64% evangelical Christian. So the voting demographics in New Hampshire and Iowa are very different. Cruz cleaned up among evangelical Christians, came in, he definitely didn't win, I forget whether he came in second or third among non-evangelicals, but New Hampshire, very different states. So I think you still have to think that Trump is the frontrunner. He's up by double digits, and obviously this debate on Saturday night could swing things one way or the other. But you have to think that Trump is still riding high in New Hampshire. This is a state that Pat Buchanan won. I don't see why Donald Trump can't win it.
Look forward. There's New Hampshire, your kind of prediction there. Look beyond it to South Carolina and on. What does this very early beginning tell us about the likely path ahead for these two? And there's the Rubio factor.
Well, I think we're definitely into a three-man race. I mean, it depends on how well Rubio performs in New Hampshire, but I think that we're definitely going to see Ted Cruz and Donald Trump in South Carolina, and then on March 1st, a lot of the states in the South, they both are very strong down there. So I think you're going to have Trump, Rubio, and Cruz in this race all until at least March 16th. March 15th, you get some of these states that begin to award delegates on a winner-take-all basis. By that point, I think you might start to see one of them drop out after that, but maybe we'll have all three of them, or maybe even one more person in this thing for the long haul, and we'll end up at a contested convention where no one has a majority of the delegates needed to secure the GOP nomination.
Rubio, with that strong third-place finish in Iowa, better than expected, and momentum out of that, saying, look, it wouldn't need a coin toss like the Democrats used at some of those caucuses for him to beat Hillary Clinton.
You'll vote for me because if I'm our nominee, we are going to beat Hillary Clinton, and it won't be by a flip of a coin.
It won't be the flip of a coin. Kelly, you spoke with Marco Rubio this week. What do you see in the Rubio campaign right now?
Well, I think when you look at what is happening on the Republican side, what is interesting is that establishment lane and how will people get behind a candidate like Marco Rubio? His great strengths are his sort of persona, his personal story. He is of a new generation and sells that very hard. He's been a voice in his time in the Senate, which is just one term, on foreign policy, which is largely in line with where the Republican Party is. But I've also spent a lot of time with the governor candidates this week, Jeb Bush, John Kasich of Ohio, Chris Christie of New Jersey, and they really take Rubio to task over the accomplishment piece. As governors, they believe they've made decisions, had to be faced with crises, and having to work through that with a record that shows they would each argue different sets of circumstances where they were tested. And they say that someone who is in the Senate in a first term, which is both Rubio and Ted Cruz, that it is a case of more about the personality and about ideology, but not about accomplishments. So in a place like New Hampshire, which has its own sort of independent streak and a different base of voters than you saw in Iowa, they are hoping that there will be, in a year that has been all about outsiders and anti-government, a surge of voters who say, we want to be sure someone who gets to the nomination and perhaps the White House actually can do some things. And so for Rubio, that's a challenge. He's being questioned about his accessibility to members of the media and even at town hall meetings. Is he really taking questions in a free-flowing way, like some of the others do? But for Rubio,
what does that mean, Kelly? Or are they planted? Or what do you mean by that?
Oh, no, I'm glad you asked that. So let me be clearer about that. Some of the governors take questions from anyone who comes and take a lot of them.
Yep.
In the Rubio settings, it has been more of his making a presentation, his stump speech, which is very stirring and has a lot of positive ideas in it, and then just a couple of questions. Let's do it in terms of volume. And then in terms of accessibility to the media covering the candidates, the term of art we use in the campaign trail trade is the gaggle. A small group of reporters who can speak to the candidate on the record, not a full press conference. And he has done fewer of those. The charge being, are you really accessible? Are you willing to be tested in an unscripted moment? That's what the sort of governor track is saying. From Team Rubio, they believe he is coalescing many officials from across the country, that his message is right, that his outlook is where the party needs to go. And this is a real test. It'll be an interesting kind of picture of where is the Republican Party going from those who want to really embrace the Republican Party, which you can say Donald Trump, never being an office holder, is sort of on the outside of that. And Ted Cruz is much more ideological and really much more about being a conservative than being a Republican.
What a season in both camps. Jack Beatty's been all over New Hampshire in this last week and more, following the candidates. He's got a great newsletter. You should sign up for it at our website, onpointradio.org. Notes from New Hampshire from Jack Beatty. Sign up for it right there. Jack, I think you were there at this moment when Jeb Bush, talking to an audience in Hanover, I think it was, town hall meeting on Wednesday, and had to actually ask for applause.
I think the next president needs to be a lot quieter, but send a signal that we're prepared to act in the national security interests of this country to get back in the business of creating a more peaceful world. Please clap.
Jack, what does that mean? What happened there?
It was actually Tuesday night. Yeah, it was a really plaintive moment, and I thought the whole evening after that had this sort of autumnal feeling about it, and the candidate at points he couldn't disguise the self-pity. I mean, you know, I'm Jeb Bush. I've got this resume. I've done all these things. These senators, Cruz, Rubio, nothing, no accomplishments. Folks, look at what I've done. It's not working. I mean, he spent $14 million in trying to sell that in Iowa. What was he, sixth or seventh? So that didn't work. It's not working according to the polls up here. It doesn't appear to be his year. His mother came up and campaigned for him, but that just, I think, sort of underlines the sense that he's a man out of his time, out of his moment, and you can just see in the rise of Rubio the establishment alternative and the establishment beginning to coalesce around this young, attractive, Floridian with the right ethnic makeup to appeal to a broader electorate. I mean, he owns that establishment lane now. That is, if tomorrow night he can get past Chris Christie, who aims to really ferociously attack him in that debate.
Watch out. That should be something. Let's go to our listeners. Detroit, Michigan, Kevin's calling. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Two quick points. One, I thought Chris's performance was, she came across as really smart, really tough, and I just feel more comfortable with her going up against a Republican candidate any day of the week.
You're talking Hillary last night, Kevin. Okay.
Second thing is, you know, I agree with Sanders about campaign finance reform. He really comes down on Clinton about having super PACs, but I think it's a bit disingenuous because if Sanders wins the nomination, I just about guarantee that a Bernie Sanders super PAC will emerge, because in the U.S., you know, campaign finance isn't going to change before November this year. And you have to have this cycle over $1 billion you're going to need in order to be president. And if he adheres to this pure, you know, liberal idea of not taking any super PACs and any, then Democrats are going to get beat, and they're going to get beat bad, okay, because they're going to get simply outspent.
Kevin, we've got it. I mean, you're channeling Hillary in many ways there. Jack Beatty, what about it? Sanders last night making a very clear point of pride in saying, no, it's not my super PAC. It's all these individual contributors, millions of them, $27 a head. That's not hundreds of millions a head. He's trying not to see that as a weakness but as a strength, Jack.
And he's making a virtue out of it. I mean, if the donations were down, he wouldn't be making so much of it.
But they're down. They're up.
Absolutely. And it works for him at both levels. He gets the money, and he's able to repudiate the big money, and to hang that on Hillary Clinton. Now she comes back and she said 60% of my donations are from women. So she plays that card back at him. This whole issue of privilege and the banks and how that stands with Hillary and the super PAC, this is going to haunt her. And, you know, you really have to step back and wonder when over 16 months, the Clintons together got $25 million in personal money from giving speeches to big corporations. There's a kind of inordinacy about that. I mean, why? Do they want to make the rubble of their riches bounce? I mean, why? Why wouldn't just sheer prudence dictate, we're not going to do that, or we're going to give it to charity, or half of it to charity? or half of it to the Clinton Foundation. Instead, into their pockets. She may be paying for that misjudgment for a long time.
John McCormick, if it would be, if it should be Hillary in the general election, does that issue go away? I mean, after all, on the Republican side, Trump's a billionaire already. Cruz's wife works for Goldman Sachs. I think Rubio's got plenty of Wall Street money. Does the issue just go away if it gets if Hillary gets past the primary hurdle?
I don't think it goes away. I mean, I think the wheeling and dealing, you know, the politics as usual, taking money, especially for these speaking fees from groups on Wall Street, that will kind of continue to dog her, to hurt her image. But, you know, to the broader point of money in politics, I think that Jeb Bush's super PAC has done a great job of proving to the American people that, you know, you can't buy elections. Bush's super PAC has spent tens of millions of dollars, and he's gone down the polls. The people he's attacking have gone up. So I think that that's kind of a nice reminder that you can't simply win an election with lots of money.
Sierra in Austin, Texas. Sierra, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to chime in. I know Hillary's been pushing this talking point that she's the most practical candidate or she's the most pragmatic choice. I actually kind of feel the opposite. I can't even think of a more polarizing figure than Hillary Clinton. there's a lot of hatred for her out there. I really believe that with the rise of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, it kind of speaks to the fact that people are kind of fed up with, you know, the establishment candidates.
Sierra, we've got it, and we can feel that polarization even within the Democratic Party. It was all about sort of who's what, who stands where, especially when Bernie stakes out political revolution. Let me get one more, if I may. Atlanta, Georgia. Kokai, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I guess I'm a little disappointed in some of the conversation. I listen to NPR for nuance, for complexity, context. And when Mr. Beatty said that Hillary had a quid pro quo and put the same bill, approved the same bill or voted, that's just, from my understanding, that's just not the fact. And I'm not a Hillary supporter. I just need someone to beat the Republican. So
he's quoting there from, I guess, Elizabeth Warren's book. But do you know that that legislation better, Kokai?
Well, it just takes, like Mr. Beatty said, just go online. And what you can see is that the bill she voted for was changed. And she stood up for some of that change. She removed the portions that would have had wives fighting with billion-dollar banks for alimony coverage. You move some of the other protections, so it was not the same bill. And to say it is, it's Fox News-ish. I'm just kind of disappointed.
Kokai, let me take it to Jack. Jack, you channeling Fox there? Kokai says she tried to make it better, pragmatically.
Well, Tom, in real time, when this happened, we spoke of this on our program. Mm-hmm. This was and this very thing came out, and it was something that Elizabeth Warren did put in her book. And I went back just now and looked at her 10-minute interview with Bill Moyers in 2004, and I basically have channeled what she said in that interview.
Okay.
She did not
Fox
say it was
Warren. Okay.
Yes, she did not say it was a different bill. And I bow to our caller. He obviously has more knowledge about the nuances of this than I do. But I was merely representing what she said. I didn't get a chance to check what she said against the bill.
One more call, Ezra, Newton, Massachusetts. Ezra, our time is short, but go for it, my friend.
Hi, Tom. As someone who's very liberal, I was really disappointed in Sanders last night. Seemed old and monochromatic. And I'd like to remind people that when LBJ was elected as VP, he was viewed sort of like Hillary, this wheeler-dealer, untrustworthy guy. And we now consider LBJ the great liberal, right? We've forgotten about Nam, so who can tell what will happen?
Ezra, I appreciate your call. Jack, the liberal wing didn't like LBJ. Hillary is the next LBJ?
Well, she could make that kind of case. Let's just hope she's not LBJ in foreign policy. And there, I think she really put Bernie Sanders in the shade. There were two debates. He got the better of the domestic stuff, but boy, did she put him in the shade talking about foreign policy.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, former price-hiking drug executive Martin Shkreli faced a House committee on Thursday with a big-time smirk and a tweet that called them, the congresspeople, imbeciles. He pleaded the fifth.
You are welcome to answer questions, and not all of your answers are going to subject you to incrimination. You understand that, don't you?
I intend to follow the advice of my counsel, not yours.
Not yours. Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania judge refused to dismiss a 2005 sexual assault case against Bill Cosby. CBS News' Jerrica Duncan was at the courthouse.
Kevin Steele, Montgomery County's current district attorney, questioned the agreement's credibility. A secret agreement that permits a wealthy defendant to buy his way out of a criminal case isn't right, he said.
And everything Super Bowl, including style and Carolina Panthers quarterback Cam Newton's wild pants by Versace.
It's Super Bowl 50. The colors are black and gold. So when I looked in my pants and I said, these are black and gold, these shoes are black and gold, to tie along with the whole Super Bowl 50, black and gold.
All right, Cam Newton and Peyton Manning, it'll be Super Bowl 50 on Sunday. We're looking at a week in the news. Iowa speaks, Cruz, Clinton, Sanders, Trump, Rubio. We got Zika fears, Syria in the spotlight, the president at a mosque this week. John McCormick is with us from the Weekly Standard. Kelly O'Donnell from NBC News. Jack Beatty is here. And we've still got political callers. Roger in Springfield, Illinois. Roger, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. It's nice to talk to you.
You too.
I listen to you all the time. I'm a shuttle driver in Springfield. And listen, I am a super Trump supporter.
Okay.
And the reason why is I really believe that Donald Trump has fooled them all. He is very, very wise, very savvy, very business. And he has led the media around like a puppy dog. And they just follow him and follow him and follow him. I think what needs to happen here is if we don't get somebody that's that savvy in the White House, we're really going to be in trouble. Bernie Sanders is of the same ilk in regards to being able to have his followers. America is speaking out, and the government is not listening. Republicans are not listening. Democrats are not listening. And I'm talking about the politicians.
Roger, I really appreciate your call, and I'm glad to picture you listening there in the land of Lincoln, Springfield. I know it very, very well. Thank you. John McCormick, this kind of comes back to your theme, and Ted Cruz hitting it this week saying, look, the media is not going to decide this election, but you hear Roger there in Illinois saying, well, Trump has used it like a genius. The outsider appeal is great. Just with the GOP, do you still think Trump can pull it out, John? Is he a contender?
He's certainly a contender. I think it's going to be very difficult at the end of the day for him to get a majority of delegates to win the GOP nomination. He might be in it for the long haul, but it's going to be tough. You know, he has been riding this wave of media attention, as a caller pointed out. And as Trump himself says, listen, they're only here because I'm good for ratings. He kind of pulls back the curtain on the system, and it's totally true. You know, he's gotten 70% of the media coverage and still came in second in Iowa. A lot of people, late deciders, they're turning against Trump. They're saying, you know what, I like him. I like that he's against the establishment. He's shaking things up. But at the end of the day, do I trust him as a commander-in-chief? Do I trust him as someone who has America's nuclear arsenal under his control, as Ted Cruz pointed out this week? I think that's much less likely to happen.
Art in Milwaukee. Art in Milwaukee, you're on, Art.
Well, I think we really need to get the transcript of Hillary's speeches at Goldman Sachs. She was asked previously by The Intercept for that, and she just laughed. Last night she said, well, I'll think about it. So I think we needed that. And on foreign policy, I think she's very vulnerable. Look what she did in Libya. You know, she wants a no-fly zone in Syria. I think Bernie could go after her more on that, and I think he should.
He certainly always goes at the Iraq vote. Kelly O'Donnell, what about that? Chuck Todd asked last night, will you release the transcript, the speeches of all those appearances you made before investment banks and others, Goldman Sachs and more? And she kind of, in a way, blew it off. You can tell. I mean, it seems unlikely, I would say, from her response that she's going to do it. I don't know why not. But that's the kind of scrutiny that piece of her bio is getting.
I also think it was an interesting moment because she is impressively prepared for debates. She's done them so many times. She spent time off the campaign trail to be refining her message for last night, knowing it was going to be perhaps a more vigorous exchange than we have seen in some of the earlier debates. And in that moment, if you look at her eyes, look at her body language, she seemed unprepared for that question, even though she has been asked before. And after the debate, some of her top allies in the campaign could not go beyond her specific words to address the situation, which suggests to me they are not actively considering that as something that they're going to need to do as a part of this campaign. So will the pressure from a caller like we just heard from the media, from voters, continue to press that, and will she feel compelled at some point to do it? I think the question when it comes to the Clintons and releasing information has always been they lean toward protection of their information. I think even when there may not be something that contains some sort of a smoking gun, they're very protective. And in part, they know that if they release anything, it is scrutinized to a detail that we don't see in almost any other circumstance. So there's a self-protectiveness that is perhaps her first gear. I think that if there is a suspicion among the public, and especially of Democratic voters, that there is more there, she will need to prove that what she is saying is accurate. And she has described that her message has been, much like other secretaries of state, her worldview, her sense of the countries around the world, which, of course, investment bankers have a high degree of interest in because they do banking and business around the world. Will that bear out? Is there something said privately that is not said publicly? Given her caution, it also would surprise me if she says something so different privately than she does publicly. But it is an issue that I think was one of the surprise moments of the debate.
Jack Beatty, you look at the Iowa outcome and what Bernie Sanders says, something like 80%+ of voters 17 to 29, of young voters. This is resonating clearly very strongly. Can Hillary just not see it? He's got his hand on a pretty strong lever here. Why not say, sure, I'll put some speeches out there? Does she just, is she in denial?
Well, I think Kelly is right. The first instinct is always go into the bunker and wait it out. And, of course, that created, really exacerbated the whole email controversy. Remember, for months they were grudging at best. And then finally, okay, here they are. They do this again and again, and it's like a reflex from years of what they see as the vast right-wing conspiracy. And, of course, there is some of that, but there's also simply the public saying, well, wait a minute, is there a conflict of interest? All the questions around the email, were you breaching national security, etc.? So, yeah, I mean, she goes right for it. My guess is that what these speeches show will be embarrassing in another way. They'll just be full of bromides about teamwork, and people will look at this and say, you paid $300,000 for this speech? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but leave it to the Clintons to make a mountain out of a molehill like this by simply not releasing it.
Paid the rent, I guess. One more on politics. Tommy in Bedford, New Hampshire. Tommy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Tom. My question is, as a New Hampshire resident, I see a lot of campaigns come through here, and my question to your panel is more around leadership. When I consider controlling the agenda, controlling the dialogue, this has by far been the most positive campaign that I've seen. And when I think about the commercials historically from the Clinton side, again, this is much more positive tone, not nearly as much mudslinging. And when I consider those aspects, I think about the leadership, and I think a lot of that has really come from the Sanders side. And I'd just like to know from your panel what their thought is around that.
John McCormick, speak to Bernie Sanders' presentation there. I mean, it is true. He just kept going back to first principles. He wasn't really flustered last night. We had a caller who said he looked old and monochromatic. But here's Tommy says, yeah, but positive, just staying on that message.
You know, I think it's very interesting. I went to his rally the night before the Iowa caucus, and he didn't mention Hillary Clinton by name once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he certainly talked about the system and Wall Street and corruption and big money and all that stuff, and you could infer that he's probably talking about Hillary Clinton or that she would be included, but you get the sense that he really believes what he says, that he's authentic, that really there's nothing that he says that is poll-tested or simply to gain votes, which I think you could make that accusation about everyone in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party running for president, that at least on one or two issues, they're just saying that because they think they're going to get votes. votes. With Bernie Sanders, there's just authenticity there. The big question I have about Bernie Sanders and the Democratic Party is whether or not voters are going to think at the end of the day, listen, he's polling better against the Republicans right now, but when people actually have to start seeing him as commander-in-chief, he can't just fall back, as he did last night, in the fact that he was against the Iraq War. As Hillary Clinton said, in her best moment, she said, you know, you can't rely on that to defeat ISIS now. The question isn't about the past. The question is what we're going to do to defeat ISIS now. And Bernie Sanders really hasn't had much to say about foreign policy. It doesn't seem like he really grasped it all that well.
We talked about Rubio. We talked about Trump. What about Cruz? I mean, he won Iowa. Do you see him as a potential winner all the way? John, he's pretty hard, right? Is that going to work with the GOP this year?
Well, with Donald Trump sort of redefining the parameters of debate, I think that he really could win. You know, usually the party ends up picking a consensus candidate, and Cruz, because of Trump, might end up being that consensus candidate. You know, he won Iowa. He's still got a chance to win New Hampshire. The field's so divided, things could break a different way. He's going to be very well positioned for South Carolina, and then on March 1st, he's got all these southern states. So I think that he can really get a head of steam going. If he gets into a one-on-one race at the end of the day with either Trump or Rubio, I wouldn't write him off. He's got a really great campaign infrastructure, and I don't think anyone should underestimate him.
Okay, we've got more to look at. Let's step back from politics for a second. And Kelly, you cover Congress all the time. Talk to us for a second about that hearing with Martin Shkreli, pharma bro, they're calling him, the guy who jacked up prices on his life-saving drug 5,000%. He sat before the congressmen and women there and just took the fifth again and again, said, I'm taking advice from my lawyer, not from you, walked out and immediately tweeted that they're a bunch of imbeciles. Kelly, are they going to come back at him, or he's made his money, he's on down the road, that's that?
Well, I want to be full disclosure. I was not there because I am on the trail, but I am very familiar with that committee and with the dynamic here and the power of taking the fifth. For a committee like this that believes the oversight role of Congress is maybe its most powerful and, by extension, most popular place in American life right now when there's so much anger toward Congress, their ability to hold, whether it be people in business or in certain governments around the country at the state level, any major actor in the national conversation, holding them to account is a powerful tool of Congress. And to have someone who has been vilified in the media, has been dealing with an issue that is so personal for people, the cost of drugs, and to be able to put him on the proverbial hot seat, and then to see a sort of youthful, snarky, disrespectful tone. Now, everyone has the right to take the fifth. That is constitutional, regardless of whether you like that person or not. And the committee was certainly trying to get some answers on things that might not have drawn him into some sort of jeopardy, although that can be perilous, too. I think his desire to not take any counsel from the committee is reasonable, but it's about the tone. And for a CEO in the hot seat as he is to show that blatant disrespect is, I think, part of what has cost him so dearly, because that disrespect may, in fact, extend to the buying public, to the people he is supposed to serve, and that is going to be part of what will follow him. Will they call him back? I think they can continue to examine the issue. I think once he has asserted his Fifth Amendment privilege, it really brings things to a halt at this point. But Congress is angry about this, and I think this is one of the topics they can try to work on.
Kelly, our time grows short, but I want to ask you briefly about another thing. This week, we had top generals from the Army, U.S. Army, and the Marine Corps testifying on Capitol Hill that American women, young women, should register for the draft. You had Mark A. Miley, I don't know how he's the chief of staff of the Army, saying, I think all eligible and qualified men and women should register for the draft. You had the Marine Corps Commandant, General Robert B. Neller, saying, look, we've already decided they're going to be in combat units based on that.
Based on this lifting of restrictions for assignment to unit MOS, that every American who's physically qualified should register for the draft.
Okay, Kelly, we don't have a draft right now, but registration is still asked. And does that stand a chance on Capitol Hill? Is that the next step here?
Well, I think that it is entirely possible because there has been such a move to give women in the military the equal access to types of jobs, because in part, one of the concerns is, why aren't there more women with stars on their shoulder? Much of that kind of advancement in the military comes from combat-tested experiences, being in the right kinds of jobs.
But that's a career framework. There's another framework here, too, whether Americans want all their daughters registering for the draft. We'll see another side of that. Forgive me, Kelly, but our time is short, and I want to hear from the president his first visit to a mosque during his presidency. Here he was saying Muslims should not listen to or believe people who say they don't have a place in America.
Let me say it as clear as I can. As president of the United States, you fit in here, right here. You're right where you belong. You're part of America, too. You're not Muslim or American. You're Muslim and American.
John McCormick, are we going to hear Republicans echo that sentiment in this campaign?
I think you did when Donald Trump came out with his idea that we should ban Muslim immigration. At first, it seemed to apply to even to U.S. citizens, which is heinous and blatantly unconstitutional. And then he said, oh, it's just about foreign people. But you heard Paul Ryan and candidates like Marco Rubio come out against that back then. You know, I think that the president's speech was just fine. George W. Bush, you know, went to a mosque after 9/11 to make sure that everyone knew that they're just as American as everyone else. I do think it is sort of an unfortunate bookend to his presidency, which began with that famous Cairo speech, all sorts of hopes that the Muslim world, due to a new president, a Democratic president who wasn't a cowboy, was going to really come around to our side. We would make lots of gains, diplomatic gains. To what extent that is a president's problem, that things have fallen apart, is a matter of debate, but things have not turned out the way he had hoped back in 2000.
Jack, you heard Trump on this just yesterday in New Hampshire, I think.
He praised President Obama in Exeter, New Hampshire, for speaking at that mosque, while Marco Rubio called it another example of Obama's pitting people against each other. That was an attack of Obama derangement syndrome, I think.
Well, that's all we've got time for right now. Earth, Wind, and Fire founder, dead this week, and we're sorry to see that go. Wonderful music for a long time. I want to thank our guest today, John McCormick, senior writer at the Weekly Standard, with us today from Manchester, New Hampshire. John, good luck with your coverage, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Kelly O'Donnell with NBC News will be watching for you on the campaign trail, and thanks for joining us today, Kelly.
Great to be with you.
Jack Beattie, see you in New Hampshire.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack's Notes from New Hampshire newsletter. Sign up for it at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Shining star for you to see what your life can truly be.